Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the Rise Above Justice Movement, the podcast. Today, I'll give a very brief viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by somebody all the way from Canada. Lola, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Feel free to introduce yourself.
Thank you so much for having me, Zachary. I'm so happy to be here and a big fan of all the super important work that you do. So my name, as you said, is Lola Graham, and I'm a trauma-informed well-being educator, a life coach, and a speaker. And I'm also a two-time survivor of sexual assault. So the interesting thing here is that with my background, it brings a look at how trauma shows up and how we can survive a little bit better when it comes to having dealt with something so darn difficult. And I really appreciate that you create the space for people to discuss what harm really looks like. So thank you so much for the work that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's dive right in and talk about, a little bit about your journey and your survivor story and what led you into recognizing the need for restorative justice in all of our communities. Because not just in Canada, but also in the United States and across the globe, restorative justice is that all, provides that alternative resource to reporting directly to police, right? And there's a lot of different options that go into restorative justice. So walk us through your journey and what restorative justice looks like to you.
Of course. Thank you so much. Yeah, restorative justice has become a really important thing to me. And I'm one of the Ontario chapter reps for Survivors for Justice Reform. So it's something that I really stand up to as an alternate pathway to seeking justice, specifically because of what I've been through. As I said, I'm a two-time survivor of sexual assault. So the first time I experienced sexual assault was when it was around my 18th birthday. It was with a person that I knew really well and I thought I could trust. And the thing is that that's quite a common story. We often hear in the media these depictions that people who are capable of rape or sexual assault are these unknown monsters who come out of nowhere. But the truth is that it's often someone that you know, someone that you trust. And that can be incredibly destabilizing to how you look at the world and how you really interact with it. So as I said, I was around 18 that first time. I had gone out with one of my best friends, her boyfriend, and one of his friends. We had been hanging out, having some drinks, a fun, normal night. And it was getting a little late, so I decided that I'd go take a nap and that everyone could wake me up when it was time to go. I didn't want to cut their fun short. But instead of being woken up to go home, I was woken up by the boyfriend's best friend, essentially on top of me, pinning me down. And I quickly, spoke up, said no, started to fight back. But the truth is, I wasn't strong enough. I was caught off guard. I didn't have the strength to fight back against another man. And my no wasn't listened to. And so he raped me that night. And the interesting thing that we don't talk about a lot when it comes to an experience like this is that we're really not informed how our bodies react to trauma. So while I tried to fight back in the beginning, after that, I froze and I even blacked out a large portion of the night. And the brain can do that really protectively. But the thing is that when you look back on something like that, I don't know, it can feel kind of like a source of shame. You're like, why can't I remember all of these details? And so there is a big part of that night that was empty for me. And I woke up in another room crying on the bathroom floor, not sure how I got there. Went home with my friend after. And the next morning, I told her what happened. I'm like, he rape me. And you can see that based on all the bruises on my body. And well, my friend had no idea how to handle something like this, so got a little upset on my behalf. We confronted him over the phone, and he just quickly started telling everyone a story of how I had been drinking too much and was just mad, and started to spread this among other people. And when faced with that, it's kind of terrifying. This was already one of the worst things that ever happened to me in my life, and I didn't know how to hold that pain already. So when faced with this, I'm like, didn't feel like I had the strength to go further. I didn't know what options existed beyond the police. And going to the police at this point didn't seem like something I felt that I could handle. I couldn't picture putting another person in jail or even seeking that kind of punishment based on this. It just wasn't where my mind went. My mind went to, I need to get away from this awful thing that I'm feeling. And so I move forward without really telling any other people. And for a long time, I simply suppressed how I felt with it. I tried to move on like nothing was really wrong. But that's the kind of thing that eats away at you slowly. And I definitely paid for that quite a bit down the line. Yet at the same time, it was still something that I had thought, okay, this happens once, it's never going to happen again. And then my second experience with sexual assault was quite different than this first experience. It was with a registered massage therapist when I had quite a bad hip injury and had been seeing this massage therapist for an incredibly long period of time. He was so trusted by family members, by the community, someone that you really just don't expect that you could ever be unsafe with. And he essentially manipulated me, continuing to tell me that I was never going to get better from the serious damage that I had done to myself, unless he was able to do certain types of treatments with me. And so slowly abused his position of power to take advantage of me. And one day I got a call from a good friend who had also been seeing this massage therapist and who was like, look, this massage therapist sexually assaulted me and told me what happened. And while her story was very different than my own, all of a sudden, this really broke down the floodgates for me. It helped me recognize what it was that I had gone through, how I had been manipulated, taken advantage of. And it brought to mind really quickly, oh my goodness, all of these other people who I had referred him too. And so, out of fear for the other women that I knew that would see him, I started to contact some of them just to say, hey, look, it's not safe to work with this person. And I ended up hearing several more stories of abuse, of women who felt ashamed at what had happened to them too. So that first person decided to go to the police to report. And after she had reported, the police put out a call in the newspaper saying, if anyone else has had anything that happened, please come forward. And so at this point, I had reported to the College of Massage Therapy of Ontario, like the regulating board. But when this call came out from the police, I decided, okay, I've got to go show up for this too. Now, when I went into the police, I was very quickly believed, which I just need to call some attention to because that's a very privileged position to be in. I know a lot of survivors who have gone to the police who haven't been believed. And so I consider myself a little lucky on that front. I was believed up front. The police heard me. They wanted to press charges. The police even shared that several other people had called into the Crime Stoppers line, which they said that they're not able to use for anything, but that they knew there were other victims out there. And so, calling a little attention to that as well, what's it say that some people were willing to call in anonymously and not go to the police? Well, that speaks about how uncomfortable so many people are with the criminal legal system. And frankly, they have the right to be. My experience from this point forward with the criminal legal system was quite awful and re-traumatizing. Frankly, your power is already taken from you when you're sexually assaulted. And that lack of power continues as you move into the system, but instead from the system itself. You're there for the system as a witness to the state. The crime that happened is no longer thought to have happened to you, but to the state. And then you are there as a witness who needs to show up in a very specific way. You need to be essentially a perfect victim for them, show up and tell your story in the way that is thought to be not too emotional, but also reliable enough, but has enough emotion to move people to matter. So you're primed essentially to no longer have any power to belong to the state that needs you to speak on their behalf, but you're there for them and they're not there for you. What happens is you're really faced with a complete lack of communication. You never know what's going on. You never know when you're going to be called. You really have no clue how things are going to move forward, continuing that feeling of powerlessness. And then it came to my first trial date, which was set for 21 months after that first arrest had been made. And our first trial got canceled. And so we got moved on to a second trial date down the line. And when that second trial date came, I had done all of the trial prep. I showed up, I was there in the courthouse and sitting in this little room waiting to go in and do one of the scariest things that I've ever done, of standing up to testify and having to see this person who caused harm again. And I was sent home without ever testifying. Delay after delay, the third trial date was set, and this was a total of 26 months later, and we never got to that trial date. By the third trial, as it was coming up, the case got stayed. Essentially, what that means is that the person who caused harm, based on the Jordan precedent, has the right to a trial within what they call a reasonable time period, which is considered to be 18 months. And beyond that, the trial can be thrown away without ever being heard. So my trial was thrown out. I didn't get to share what happened. I didn't get to stand up for the community. I felt like I was trying to do the right thing of searching for a way to hold this person accountable, but nothing came of it aside from re-traumatization for me and a further hurting of that power dynamic, of that feeling of being out of control of your life. So at this point, they had tried, first of all, to say that COVID was the reason for some delays. They tried to excuse the time, and they found that even taking COVID into account, that the system didn't move fast enough. On top of that, the first crown that was assigned to our case had gone let go because he made mistakes with paperwork and a new crown had to come in. Then police misfiled some evidence. So essentially, in the end, there was just too much wrong for the case to be able to move forward. So we're creating this narrative that the only reasonable thing to do is to report after you've been assaulted. And yet, the cases aren't being prioritized in a way that even gets them heard. And so the bottom line is that about only 6% of people actually report, and I've been in that non-reporting category as well. And then when people do report, It's something as low as around 2% of cases in the area of sexual violence actually see like legal sanctions. So we're asking survivors to show up and do this incredibly difficult thing that hurts them without getting any results. And this right here is what brings me to the need for restorative justice. I was so lost after all of this. And thankfully, in the end, the College of Massage Therapy, after another long 27-month process, so 4.5 years altogether, they finally took away his license. I am grateful for that. But what's the point of going to the criminal legal system if it's just going to hurt you and not actually hold the person accountable? So when I was lost and searching, what can be done? How do I live in a world like this where we can't hold accountable the people who cause harm? And what do I actually think accountability is? I came across restorative justice from the work of Marlee Liss and Survivors for Justice Reform, which is a global coalition that stands up for restorative justice, a process that centers survivors' needs, that centers survivors' healings, and seeks to actually deliver accountability. And what that accountability looks like, what that process looks like, can be dependent on what the specific survivor needs, what that specific case allows. But what we see here is that restorative justice has been shown to lower rates of recidivism, so people are less likely to repeat that harm. And we know that when someone does actually get a legal sanction, maybe goes to prison, that that atmosphere often doesn't help a person become a better member of society. So for me, the fight for restorative justice is really about not putting survivors through that pain, giving another option when something that terrible has happened, so they actually have a choice in how to move forward. Survivors aren't a monolith. Everyone wants something different. And then finally asking, what can a process of accountability and repair possibly look at? How can we make sure the survivor's taken care of while also hopefully giving the person who caused harm an experience that can help them become a more productive member of society again and hopefully never do something like that again. So, restorative justice has been a light for me. It's given me a pathway to actually understand that bad things can happen, but there are pathways that can actually deal with that harm. And when we understand them, we have a choice of how we want to move forward, a choice of the world we want to create, a choice of how we help people continue to be productive members of the society, and how we help those who have experienced harm actually get better and actually heal.
Absolutely, because we know that healing is not linear, it is complex, so I would love for you to kind of jump in and talk about what healing has looked like for you. Obviously, being a part of Survivors for Justice Reform is a part of that healing, but what else has been a part of your healing journey for you, and what does it look like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really great question. Thank you. Healing, I think it's important to understand that it's a complex thing that doesn't get solved overnight. Like, we're not looking at a linear process here that everyone can walk through exactly the same way as everyone else. So, we need to be a little flexible when we consider healing. One of the reasons why restorative justice and advocacy has been such a big part of my life is that with a pathway of advocacy, what you do is you not only regain some control in your life, but you also get to put the feeling of hopelessness to the side. You can look at the fact that your relationship with the world and with how you see society has been a little bit broken, that you're not okay with how things are, but that that's not the end of the line. So when you're stuck in that point of healing, when you're mad at what has happened, when you're grieving everything you've lost, you really need to find that way to rebuild a relationship with the world. And for me, advocacy has given me that solid ground to stand on because I can see solid hope for a different future. So that relationship with the world is one big part of it. And then outside of that, it really comes down to two, how do you rebuild a relationship with yourself? The thing of going through something like sexual assault is that it really hurts how you look at yourself and how you interact with yourself. It's so easy to slip into an experience of shame and self-blame after something like this because you just don't know how to make sense of what's happened. And when it comes to shame and self-blame, there are kind of two different types of self-blame that exist. One is something called characterological self-blame. So this is kind of where you blame yourself, like who you are, your innate character, as being part of the problem. This, as a survivor, can come down to things like feeling that your voice doesn't matter, that you were maybe naive to think that nothing could have happened there. You're manipulated by a person and you feel like you're not good enough. Otherwise, you maybe wouldn't have been manipulated, or you get stuck in some societal messaging. So, with societal messaging here, we have things like the manosphere that spend time speaking down about women and that they're just inherently not good enough. We have systems of oppression that have really dangerous and upsetting rhetoric, especially about marginalized communities. So there are so many ways that you can fall on blaming yourself and your character, but then you can also fall into the second type of blame, which is a behavioral self-blame that says, if only I made better choices, I would never have been in this situation. And here's where we really get into that victim-blaming rhetoric, where society sees it a lot easier almost to blame the victim as the fault, because then if the victim could have made a different choice, on some level, as a society, we don't have to reckon with what it means to accept the fact that there are reasons to know that we aren't necessarily safe, that we aren't in control of everything that happens with us, and that lack of control is terrifying. So, how do we take away that feeling of lack of control? Well, we blame people for their choices. So, I found that as a survivor, it's easy to fall into both of these kind of blames, like, oh, if only I was better, this wouldn't have happened, or if I had made different choices, then maybe I never would have been in these situations. But in the end, these lead to a really harmful relationship with yourself, where it's easy to try to hide the pain that you're feeling, try to move on quickly, as society often pushes. Oh, at least now you can move on. I heard that quite a bit. Oh, your trial didn't go through, but at least now you can move on. You can put it behind you. That kind of language is really difficult to sit with, especially when your body is still living in a constant state of trauma, when your body is responding in ways that it's never felt before, when your nervous system is on high edge and you don't know how to feel safe in your skin again. You can get into really destructive patterns, or you can try and suppress what goes on. So, all of these pieces were a part of my pathway, and healing meant having to figure out how to shift that relationship with myself again. So, for me, that was about redefining well-being. I could no longer look at well-being as this outdated idea of good vibes only, where you have to try and put forward some sort of smile or a perfect version of yourself for society. I needed to throw that out the window and start to understand that maybe life looked like being able to hold all of the ranges of emotions at once. So, understanding that I could rediscover joy even if both grief and rage were also present, that I could learn how to make the most of my days and laugh and connect with people and love things about life while at the same time also holding the recognition that there's a lot wrong that I think needs to be changed. So well-being became a way of self-reclamation, a way of saying that I accept all parts of me. And that's a really big thing for healing. Can you accept all parts of you? Can you learn how to sit with the range of emotions? Can you learn how to show yourself care no matter what happens and what comes up? So I had to relearn how to care for myself, which as a well-being educator was really interesting because it took what I had known and asked me to reconstruct it in a way that sit with this reality of harm and a way that no longer dismissed me, where I started to say, you know what, I'm going to let go of all the ways that I've tried to conform myself to better fit and instead embrace who I am authentically and figure out what that care looks like, figure out how to interact with the world in a way that helps me feel better, in a way that helps me have hope again, in a way that honors my bad days as much as I honor my good. And once again, restorative justice has been a big part of that. Because when you learn about the restorative justice process, you learn that it's not only about fixing and dealing with the harm between you and the harm dealer doer, but sometimes it comes down to as well, how do you readjust and have accountability with yourself? So if you've been stuck in that self-blame piece, how do you go through a process of saying sorry for yourself? had to learn how to apologize to myself properly. Like, I'm sorry that I blamed myself when it was the person who caused harm that is the person who really deserves the blame. And how do I make that sorry genuine? How do I rebuild that relationship with myself? How do I show myself that I'll be there with myself no matter what? And that's really what the healing process was about, is finding and adapting and evolving what it meant to care for myself through all of the different stages. And I think it's a beautiful process because you learn how to be there for yourself through it all. And if you can be there for yourself through it all too, you also learn how to be there better for your community too. And essentially, strengthening that relationship with yourself helps you strengthen the relationship with others too, because we realize that, we're all often going through something, even if you can't see it. So if I want to be shown that care, then I want to be able to be there for and show that care to others too.
You said a very key thing, and just really talking about the healing process, I think is something that is not talked about like nearly enough, right? And it's oftentimes overlooked because what would have worked for me may not have worked for you or the next person, the next person, the next person. Because again, healing is not linear, it is very complex. And I have to agree, I did not know what restorative justice was until like very recently, within like the last year. And I learned about it more because of Marley and because of Survivors for Justice Reform, which I serve as the Kansas rep, the Kansas representative. And learning about the restorative process and learning about what is possible, I think it's really opened my eyes a lot. And it's lit like a whole different fight within me, within myself, to kind of recognize the alternative methods. Because oftentimes, survivors are asked, why didn't you report? Or why did you wait so long to report? And we need to shift that narrative and shift that question of asking why and start asking who made it difficult for you to report. There is language in this regard does matter. And I think you do a very, very good job at recognizing that shifting language. So I'm incredibly inspired by your story, but also, just the work that you do in the restorative justice space as well. And I think it's just very intriguing. Now, thinking about that, being in Canada, looking at the United States, what do you see right now? Like, how do you feel kind of looking at the United States and looking at the state of the rest of the world, how do you see everything going on right now?
Oh, what a great question. Thank you for that. So when I look at everything that's going on in the world right now, oh goodness, it hurts my heart in so many ways because what we see is a replication of the power imbalance that makes sexual assault so prevalent. We see people in power abusing that power consistently. We see a constant rhetoric of othering. And instead of looking at the fact that the things that are causing the problems, for instance, is, things like an improper distribution of wealth, the fact that people have such a difficult time just making ends meet, when we come down to who's actually to blame? Those in power really lean on this idea of othering marginalized communities to achieve being able to stay in power, to achieve being able to continue with these imbalances, with these systems of harm that support the few while hurting the generalized population. And what happens is that not only is this incredibly, incredibly harmful and alarming for the marginalized communities who are being attacked, for example, right now, immigrants and the trans community, when we listen to that language of othering, what happens is that it teaches us that who we are and how we show up in the world is at risk of getting us thrown out or demonized by society. The fact that certain populations are being held up as the reason these bad things are happening, and very incorrectly so, makes people become hyper aware that we need to show up ideally in a way that fits the norms, that doesn't ruffle feathers, that keeps us being accepted. And so you see a lot of people adopting this horrible language to try and, if anything, even show, hey, I'm not a part of that group, so I deserve to stay in this privileged position. That's such a toxic attitude that really teaches us all to hide the things that we're ashamed of, to not seek the healing that we need. And it really causes us to throw away the basic empathy and recognition of common humanity that would allow for a better world to be created. So when I see what's going on right now, it hurts my heart in many ways to know, first of all, what those in the marginalized communities are having to deal with when it comes to hearing themselves put down on a regular basis with that, especially when you think of it, like the trans community, especially. I think that it's so darn beautiful that someone can stand up and say that this is who I am and I want to be accepted for my authentic self. Yes, we need more of that in this world. That's what healing looks like, to be able to say that this is who I am and who I am isn't dependent on a norm or on what society says in a certain way, and instead is an authentic reflection of who I am, and I'm going to let that shine. That's gorgeous. We need more of that. But so we see people constantly getting stuck in these harmful systems of hate. And then at the same time, we see other communities coming together consistently to fight for a better way. And that's where there's hope. If you can find even one area of advocacy to involve yourself in, that's how we build a better world. We can't sit back and let this happen. And part of that starts with healing ourselves too, because we need to be able to learn how to hold empathy for ourselves and others. That requires emotional and mental health and well-being. That requires us to be mindful about how we're showing up, how we're influencing others. So, on one hand, there's a lot of hope in the way that people are coming together to care for themselves and each other. We can continue, I think, to garner a lot of strength if we're not willing to give up. And just like Survivors for Justice Reform has given me something huge to stand up for, it also reminds me, okay, if I'm here doing this work, standing up for justice reform, standing up against things like gender-based violence, I also know that other people aren't doing important work in the many other areas of advocacy that's needed. And so that just gives me a lot of hope. So we can't take the change on ourselves for every aspect of the world. I think we can do our best to live responsibly, to be allies to different communities, to show up in ways that helps to create the kind of world that we want to live in. But we can look at and say, where do we have capacity? What do we care about deeply? What do we want to get involved in? And if we all work together to do our part, I think that there's a lot of hope for the future. And we saw that last night with some of the elections, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I mentioned to you before we started recording that I have a lot of friends that won their elections across the country last night. And these are people that I have talked to. They know my story. They know my journey. They know about my mom and her cancer journey. And they're going to take that energy to the city halls, to the state capitals. They're going to take that energy to their mayor's offices. And, you know, I want to give a big shout out to Zohran Mamdani for winning in New York City last night. Yes, I get emotional because that's a big, big sign that change is possible. And he defeated somebody who was found credibly for sexually harassing 13 women. Andrew Cuomo is a serial predator, and he is going back to New Jersey now. A rumor has it, moving to Florida. Hasta la vista is all I gotta say. Because New York City turned the fuck out last night and yesterday and broke records, broke history. So do I feel a sense of optimism? Yes, I do. I feel that people like my mom will be represented. I feel that people in my community, as survivors, as LGBTQ, as disabled, will be represented very, very well. So again, congratulations to Zohran Mamdani and all of my friends across the country who won their elections last night, because this is the momentum that we need to build on, and this is what courage looks like. It's not an easy job to run for office, but I strongly encourage anybody, you know, if you want to run for office, I can help. I am willing to help. I am willing to donate my time to get you across that finish line. And Lola, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I am so excited to continue learning more about you, learning more about the work that you do. And, you know, I am so excited to continue collaborating in the restorative justice space with Marley and Survivors for Justice Reform, and just being the vocal voice that you are is so incredibly healing, not only to me, but also to everybody around you. And is there anything else you wanted to share with the audience today, or any like words of advice, or you know, how can people find you on social media and uplift your work as well?
Yeah, thank you so much. And I just want to echo what you said too about how amazing these political wins have been. And I want to thank you as well for continuing to strengthen so many of these voices. The space that you create is so healing, so important. And I think that the more that we're willing to speak about these sources of harm out loud, the more that we have the courage and power to stand up against them. And so, what I would say to everyone is to remember that there is hope, that it is absolutely okay if you aren't feeling great right now. Those, signals of anxiety, of grief, of rage are so incredibly valid. And I would just urge you to learn how to care for those parts of yourself and at the same time to not forget how to stand up for radical joy at the same time. We need to nurture those pieces as well so that we have the strength to keep going. I really believe that our well-being is a source of resistance because when we learn to care for ourselves and our communities, that's how we continue to have the strength, the power to stand up and create powerful change. With all of the wins that we saw yesterday, that really only happens when we're able to take care of each other and support this work being done. So, pause and ask yourself, how can I best support myself? How can I best show myself the care that I deserve? Because you do deserve care. You are worthy. You are enough. And whatever has happened, if it is something like sexual assault, it surely was not your fault. And you deserve care. And then on the other hand, it's the question of how can you help care for the world around you? What is your thing? We all have it. And I can guarantee you that whatever your thing is, it is important. It matters. The world needs more of it. Your light counts. So if you want someone to help you in that well-being journey or to continue these kind of conversations, you can find me on social. My handle is at lovelolagram. And I look forward to connecting with you more. Thank you again so much for taking the time to talk with me today. Your work is so powerful and I appreciate it.
Likewise, my friend, you take care of yourself, okay?
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.